No Regrets. Cafe Conversations with Madeline Smith in conversation with Bill Lawrence. Episode 1.
And in this episode, Maddie takes another deep dive with me into her life, talking with no regrets about a professional conflict, a difficult director, and a cruel situation, and talking straight from the heart about some wrong decisions, bad reviews, bad advice, and typecasting. Well, hello, Maddie, and it's great to be back here in the cafe for more conversations for this series 2 of your podcast. And it's got a very interesting and intriguing title. And to begin with, I'd like you to tell me just why exactly you've chosen to call this series No Regrets.
I will, Bill. I will indeed. I want to make it very clear to you that I have had a fantastic career. So many golden opportunities, so much fun, and so much satisfaction. However, inevitably, in anybody's life, there have been a few regrets. But I will say, and we will add, and we did title it as No Regrets, I don't actually regret, because I put it all down to experience. But I would recommend to people, when they've heard some of my stories, that they do think very carefully what was their first reaction when they got a job. So, in 1980, I had already started on the long and joyous path towards getting a degree, an English degree. I had given up acting for a time, or so I thought I'd done, and went to Goldsmiths College to study English. And all 3 years are among the best years of my life, but that is another section altogether. So I had been at Goldsmiths for, I think, just about a year, and the Manchester Royal Exchange offered me a part in a pseudo-Fado farce. It wasn't actually Fado. I can't remember the name of the author. I think it was a double act. I think there were two authors of this strange farce called Nothing to Declare. And I remember that we had a marvellous actor in it called N. Rytel, who at the time was king of voiceovers, a delightful young man. But anyway, I digress. So I remember seeking advice from the wonderful Patrick Garland, director Patrick Garland. Patrick, what do you think? I've got permission to take a term off Goldsmiths. You know, the head of department allowed me to take a term off. Shall I do this? Shall I go all the way up to Manchester and stay there? I do suffer terribly from homesickness. Shall I do this? The Royal Exchange has a fantastic reputation and the part is wonderful. She was a madame, the character, and had the whole central section of the play to herself, and it was to star Brian Cox and, well, me, and an actress called Dilys Hamlet, a wonderful lady, and to be directed by Braham Murray. Now, I hadn't met Braham. He had a very, very fine reputation. In fact, the Manchester Royal Exchange itself had a wonderful reputation, 1980. It's a bubble theatre. It's in an old corn exchange in Manchester and has a reputation second to none, absolutely even Stevens with anything that London can offer. So I thought, how flattering. Patrick said, go do it. And at the same time, he was asking me what my advice was about his future marriage, and I gave him my opinion. He gave me his, and I went away happy. Okay. Well, I arrived in Manchester, which is a fantastic city, and first morning of rehearsal, wandered up to shake hands with Braham Murray. He took one look at me. Oh, he said, I didn't know you were a virgin. My heart sank. I really didn't know what on earth he meant. And I have to say truthfully, from that moment on, that man never spoke to me. It was absolutely terrible. We rehearsed, but it was almost through sign language or just me learning the lines and doing it. He played about all the time like a puppy dog with Brian Cox. They were wonderful, wonderful mates. It was a joy to behold. They literally gambled through the play. I was so alienated, and nothing that I had done. And on another occasion, I was walking past a poster, and Brian Murray suddenly rudely took me aside and he said, you see that poster? You see that actress there, Carmel McSherry? And indeed, I did know Carmel McSherry. I had worked with that wonderful lady in a program called Cribbins. I loved her. Yes, he said. She walked out on me, the last production. And I'm telling you, if you do that, you will pay for every performance that you have mucked up. And I looked at him in complete disbelief. What? I had no intention of walking out. Why are you saying these things to me? He made my life hell, and I'm confessing this now, because it is a warning to anybody that accepts a job without talking it through, without meeting the director, without meeting the fellow actors, at least. Please, please, I beg anybody not to make the same mistake I did. I don't know what he had wanted from me. I don't know what, you know, even what I'm implying. But I know that from the get-go, that man hated me. And I'll say no more. I know I wasn't one of the regulars. They had a regular rep up there, and I had been warned. It's very, very cliquey up there in Manchester. I mean, talk about wonderful, you know, actors like Tom Courtenay, absolutely fantastic, if only he'd been in it. Brian was very pleasant to me. Everybody, you know, was sort of quietly pleasant. But I did notice that nobody socialised with me. It was almost as though I had leprosy. It was such an unhappy 3 months. The play was brilliant. I'm sure we had good reviews. Except one night, I actually leapt ahead to another scene and they had to bring Brian Cox on very quickly. But anyway, and the very quickly was not easy because being a bubble theatre, the dressing rooms were actually elsewhere in the Corn Exchange and nowhere near the theatre itself. That was an experience in itself. And a lovely, lovely actor called John Phillips went and tore his hamstring and was miserable throughout. But it really was a very, very unhappy time, incomparable to anything else I have ever done, and I have never, ever fathomed the reason. I know a lot of people might disagree with me, but when you have made a certain amount of progress in this wonderful profession, don't backtrack. Even if you are desperate, even if you've been unemployed for a year or two or more, don't go back to square one. It doesn't work. I was offered understudying work by a very sweet friend, lovely, lovely man, Joe Scott Parkinson. And I accepted it. He knew I hadn't been employed for a long time. I'd been widowed. Life was awful, actually. And I accepted understudying the wonderful Jane Asher. Gorgeous, gorgeous lady. And Rufus Sewell was in this particular play. And it was directed by Michael Rudman, who at the time had, I think, been divorced by or separated by Felicity Kendall. When I went to meet him to be interviewed for this job, understudying dear Felicity and not Felicity, Jane Asher and Marcia Warren, he said to me, Michael Rudman said to me, "Excuse me, weren't you at some point reasonably well known? What are you doing sitting here?" I thought, whatever, you know, whatever. And I said, "Yes, but, you know, like anybody, I need to work. You know, I've got to hone my craft. I can't just sit at home and think about being widowed. And I also have a little girl to support, you know, so..." "All right," he said, "okay, well, you can do this job then." On one occasion, I was sitting completely silently, as I always did, in the rehearsal room, and these wonderful actors were doing their bit, and there was a lull. And when I say I sat silent, I sat silent. There was no small talk and no contributions allowed from the understudy, which was me. And that I understood from day one, a very chill feeling. Jane Asher was absolutely lovely, I've got to emphasise, and Marcia and Rufus. And they were talking about Hamlet in a lull in the rehearsals, and I took one look at Rufus Sewell, who was then incredibly young, in his 20s still, and I put my hand up, and Rudman said to me, "Yes." And I said, "Rufus would be a fantastic Hamlet." "It isn't your job to comment. Your job is to sit in that corner and keep quiet." So I gently, quietly walked out of the room. Dear Jane Asher came up to me, put her hand to her head and said, "He's nuts." And I asked Joe Scott Parkinson, "Can I walk out? Can I? I don't think I can bear this." And he said, "You're a pro, Maddie. You're going to stick it out." And stick it out I did. But I really do implore anybody who has gone past the stage of understudying or whatever to think very, very carefully indeed as to whether that's a good idea. And I remember Marcia Warren saying to me that she felt very awkward about me understudying. And in fact, that was actually a different production with Marcia. I'm wrong. That was something else where I also understudied. And that was her remark. "I'm so sorry. It was Jane Asher and Rufus. It was not Marcia Warren. That was a play called The Weekend." A completely different play. Yep, I did it twice. But anyway, I don't know. People won't agree with me. I've got an actress friend who said to me at the time, "Don't do it. Don't do it." And what I will add is this. I think Michael Rudman felt very awkward about this. I think he felt strange. But when I met him again at a funeral, at Richard Brier's funeral, and I went up to him and I said, "Friends? I can't talk to you now. I have to talk to some people." And he stormed off. So you can imagine, my heart is actually racing, remembering this now. And it's just so needlessly cruel, and there's no need for this kind of thing.
Could I ask, Maddie?
Yes.
That sounds quite an awful couple of situations that you're in there.
Yes, Bill.
But being an understudy in itself, is that quite a difficult thing in terms that do you feel as though you're not quite fully at the same level as everyone else? Do you feel that you are the office junior, as it were? Is being an understudy anyway a sort of a difficult position to be in?
Absolutely not. It is a great honour to be an understudy. And that's why this was such a disgusting performance from Mr. Rudman. I couldn't understand it at the time. That was the only moment where I said anything. Now, normally, understudies are absolutely a part of the company. They are included. I've always adored my understudy. We've exchanged gifts and drinks and suppers. When I was in a play called Habeas Corpus with the darling Patricia Hayes, she and my understudy Wendy and I, we used to go out to tea all the time, suppers between the shows. fraternizing all the time. I have never, ever experienced anything. It is absolutely a vital part of any show. You are part of the company. This was disgusting behavior. But I still, unfortunately, have to say that perhaps when you've gone through that and out the other side and become a performer, you know, in your own right, maybe I proved, or maybe Rudman was just being vile, I don't know. But whatever it was a singularly unpleasant experience. And again, as in Manchester, I hadn't done anything wrong. If I'd been having an outrageous affair with Rufus or something, and he thought that was, not the thing to do. But I mean, nothing could have been further from the truth. So I just, I'm only saying, these are just experiences that I have had. Whether Michael Rudman has a reputation of being unpleasant to people, I have no idea.
So he's saying very much you should follow your instincts, and you know yourself when things are right and when things are wrong, and you should follow those instincts. So there have been other occasions in your career where you have felt that your instinct is telling you one thing, but your business manager or your agent or even your own business brain is telling you to do something else.
Yes, yes, yes. I accepted a part, a singing role in Coventry for Pal Joey, and I was so awful. I was so dreadful, and I'm so ashamed of my performance. Wonderful man, Bob Carlton, who directed it, now sadly deceased. I was so aware that I was inadequate. I didn't really want to take it. They were hard up there in Coventry, and dear Bob Carlton was trying, it was his home turf, he was trying desperately to raise some funds for the theatre at the time, and he had been in love with the film Up Pompeii and my silly little scene in the bubble bath, and he thought to have Maddie in it would be great fun, but I think I probably brought the whole show to ruin. I was completely inadequate, so self-conscious every night. They couldn't have been lovelier to me. A wonderful lady called Kate Edgar tried to take me through the part, you know, and singing jazz, and, you know, maybe if dear Coventry had the money for us to rehearse for months, maybe like the RSC do, I might have been vaguely adequate. But I feel so ashamed of myself, and I should really have followed my instinct and said, gosh, how flattering to be asked. But I'm going to be dreadful, and dreadful I was. And I got the most awful review, fully deserved, and brought it on myself from a critic called Charles Spencer, who obviously loathes me anyway. He couldn't wait to turn the knife, and turn it he did. And that is his prerogative. I mean, you know, it was deserved. I loved being up there in Coventry. It's a wonderful place. It suffered so much in the war. My heart goes out to it, even thinking about it. I actually saw a programme the other day about the blitzing of Coventry. Absolutely dreadful. Dreadful. And I was glad to try and help the theatre, but I fear I didn't. I made good friends with the security man there. He liked me, but I think that was about it. No, and Bob Carlton, oh, golly, Journey to the Forbidden Planet. Oh, all the awards he got. And my lovely, lovely, darling friend, Christian Roberts, who was in it. Oh, such a lovely cast. Such a lovely cast up there in Coventry.
Now, it's very interesting, Maddie, you talk about your reviews, your awful reviews. Now, to what extent, in your experience, do actors actually read their reviews or care about their reviews, or do they does everyone pretend not to care when deep down it's the first thing they read?
Bill, I'm going to tell you that that was a review I hadn't read, and it was sent to me. It was sent to me by little monkey Margaret. Margaret had been my now deceased husband's agent and friend, and subsequently great friend to me, but she was a minx, was Margaret. And she sent me that review, and she said, I think you'll enjoy this. And you know, in a funny kind of a way, I did, because it reinforced what I've said about the no regrets. And I really do want to emphasize that I actually don't have any regrets about any of these experiences, because what it does, it leads you to not repeat. And I would like to go back, for Bill's sake as well, and for any person out of drama school or wanting to act, please take it from me. Understudying is a vital part of theatre. It is wonderful. It's the same as stand-ins on films, extras. Without it, theatre can't survive. Without an understudy, if you're ill, who's going to go on? Very often the understudy is much better than the leading man or the leading lady, and it leads to great things, and you get seen, and it's wonderful. This was an exception. And my instinct at the time was not to do it. And again, I think probably because Rudman was so strange to me when I met him, I should have said, no, I don't think I'll do it. So emphatically, I will go back on Bill's and my title of this section, which is No Regrets. What I'm doing here, as I'm very old now, I'm in my 70s, and I'm just opening up my heart. And I'm kind of, it's a sort of reprieve in a way. I'm sort of airing things, people who've been rotten to me for absolutely no reason whatsoever. And I don't know, it's a sort of expunging my soul, really.
It's very very honest of you, Maddie, and to talk about these things. Over your very, very long career, have there been other moments, though, when you've come across people and you thought, I don't want to be doing this, I've made a mistake working for you, or I've been badly advised? Is it bad advice that you get sometimes in the theatre?
I don't actually have any real other regret, except I think, and this is probably a whole other chapter, I think I regret that I allowed myself to get slotted into tits and bum parts. When I made a programme or series called Doctor at Large, that was kind of the best I ever did. In a way, I was playing myself, Arthur Lowe's daughter. Wonderful, the wonderful, wonderful Arthur. Oh my goodness, it doesn't get any better than that. And playing his daughter for 5 episodes. And then unfortunately, I mean, I then did the wonderful 2 Ronnies, about which, you know, Bill and I might speak, I don't know. But as a result of that, I became a foil. And I should have stuck to my guns and said, no, I don't want to do just that. And I should have tried to redirect, you know, as many actors do, back into playing just normal girly parts, or, you know, really fight to be a proper actress rather than just a foil. Because in a way, it kind of grounded my career. I wasn't strong enough. And I would say to any actor, and that is something about which I have regret, because it became so boring it nearly crucified me. I would say to any actor, please don't allow yourself to get too stuck. Be brave, take yourself off that groove, and go and insist that you play different parts. It doesn't matter if you go into rep, you know, go to Aberystwyth, go to Inverness, it doesn't matter. Get out there, show what you can do, show yourself what you can do. Don't allow yourself to be typecast, because that really is death to any career.
But over such a long career that you've had, Maddie, you've not been typecast. I mean, a very, very long career. and at different stages you chose to do different things, television, film, stage, children's television as well. So the fact that you've never been really typecast, and you know, it can be seen over the wide variety of things you've done. A very positive spin to say no regrets over such a long career as well.
Well, that's very kind of you, Bill. I do regret, and in point of fact, I did get typecast. And the other day, I happened to come across a poster of a play I did, I think in 1977, where my career really was unwinding completely. You know, my billing was right at the bottom of the poster with a wonderful character actor called Ken Wynn, who always deserved better. And there I am at the bottom, and I was so bored during that time with, you know, my five lines every night. Best part was giving the kiss of life to the gorgeous Frank Thornton. but really, I had absolutely nothing to do in it. And, you know, I had literally unwound. And that's when I potted off and did my English degree and then the Manchester thing. And it was my salvation was the wonderful Clive Doig, who then put me into series after series of children's television, and that was absolutely fantastic.
So thanks, Maddie. No regrets. What a fantastic, inspirational and motivational position and positive position to have.
Thank you very much indeed, and I really mean it. That comes from the heart. I actually have no regret whatsoever about anything.
Was episode 1 of No Regrets with Madeline Smith.